Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. And this is our Friday show. It's been an awesome week. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Call in with your questions. Dr. Michael, hi.
Hi, sweetie. It's a delight to be here again this morning. And on this Easter weekend, and we'll check and see if there's anything happening in the chat room in the way of questions, and or anybody on the line that has a question to kick off our show today. Jeannie?
Nope, not yet.
Okay, wonderful. Well, one of my thoughts today was to speak a little bit, because we've been working with the ancient Aramaic ideas of the man named Yeshua, and so many of those ideas have been distorted by coming out of the original Aramaic context, the original Aramaic language, and moving into Greek and then or Latin and Old English and then Modern English, that distortions have occurred. And when I introduce the Aramaic, I like to tell a little story, and if you'll bear with me, I'd like to share this idea. And let's imagine that we're getting ready to do a workshop. We're actually looking to set some things up in Pahrump, Nevada in the next couple of weeks. And so we set up a workshop in Pahrump, Nevada, and one of the people who lives out there gets a note from a friend in Russia who wants to come to the workshops. And, of course, I don't speak any Russian, and this man doesn't speak any English, but he wants to come. And so this person who's a friend of his is absolutely the best translator of Russian into English and English into Russian on the planet. And he says, well, I've got a space for this fellow to come. It's all right if he comes over, and I'll house him. We'll spend some time together, and I'll get him back to the airport as he's leaving. And this fellow, you know, arrives, we as a group, let's say a number of us go to the workshop, and as a group we get together a couple of times for lunch or dinner and spend some time and just have a great time with this fellow. And at the end of his visit, as he's getting ready to go back to the airport, I ask you as the Russian translator to tell him that I think he's really cool. And you turn to him in your best Russian and share with him that Michael thinks he's got a low body temperature. Now, you translated my words perfectly, but you didn't say a word about what I meant. And sadly, there are many things. When I said he's cool, I used an idiom. There's nothing literal about an idiom. There's another level of meaning. It's something that a person who lives in a culture knows as meaning, but someone outside of the culture has no clue what that meaning is unless they've studied it. And so when this fellow translates my words as you've got a low body temperature, he's taking a translation of a word void of meaning, and the Aramaic language is absolutely rife with idioms. And being rife with idioms, so much is lost in terms of practical application, because many of the phrases that were used are idiomatic. You can have the best Greek translators in the world out of the Aramaic. You can have the best translators out of the Greek into the English. If you don't know the idiom, you cannot translate meaning. What we've done with the work we're doing, and for those who might not know this, I'm the director of a foundation that's translating a copy of the oldest known New Testament in Aramaic into the English language. And in translating that text, basically 25 translators were involved, and until 25 translators agreed on a translation, that was not acceptable as a translation. And then what we knew was we had a good translation, but did we have meaning? The next step was to take that translation and put it into the laboratory of the classroom and apply it. And in the laboratory setting, did it work? If it didn't work, then we knew we didn't have an accurate translation. And so the end result ideas that you're hearing in our radio show, in our DVDs, in our CDs, in my book, and in all of the Aramaic context, has gone through those stages of translation, comparison with other experts' translations, a bottom line in that translation. And then, if it didn't work in the laboratory, we'd go back to the translators. Something's not right. We don't have a complete meaning here. And so the idioms in the Aramaic are so profound, and so much gets lost if they're not translated properly. For instance, we're told that there's a law, and the first law is you've got to love God, love neighbor, love self. And there are 17 different words that have been translated by one English word, love. And that the word that was used in that particular passage is the word rachma. And interestingly enough, of course, we've translated it in our culture as some kind of emotional feeling you're supposed to have toward another. And that's totally and completely out of context and out of harmony with what the Aramaic word meant. The word rachma in Aramaic is a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that inoculates your brain against the human insanities of hostility and fear. It's got nothing to do with your behavior or your feelings toward another. Now, it will produce certain behaviors and certain feelings toward another, but the condition itself, when the man named Yeshua said, you must have rachma toward God, toward neighbor, toward self, he was saying that there's a condition in your mind which allows you to live a human life. Without that condition, you live in hostility and fear, and you don't have a human life. And we establish human life and the definition of human life by simply imagining holding a newborn. Everyone who's held a newborn knows what human life is, and it is love. It's always described everywhere on the planet as the active presence of love in some way, shape, or form when you ask people about the essence of the newborn that they've held. So when you put that together, what you find is that human life is the presence of love. And what the man named Yeshua 2,000 years ago, as opposed to giving you a directive as to how you're supposed to treat a neighbor or the Creator or yourself, he was saying that you had to maintain a condition in your mind that would allow you to live a human life and not get lost in the insanities of hostility and fear. Now, you see that when you start to recognize from the Aramaic the power of that. Question that the genie will ask when we do a Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop is, how many have ever done something they regret? And then she asks them to identify what they were feeling when they did whatever it was. You know, what feeling prompted you to do that? And the list that we get when that question is asked is always some form of hostility and fear. We go into regret because we lose contact with our humanness, which is where there is choice. And when we lose contact with our humanness, where there is choice, we don't have choice. We simply function out of whatever's stored in our physiology. So what was being taught 2,000 years ago was how to maintain a human life in the presence of some things that were kind of inhuman. In the presence of anything that you could possibly experience, if you maintain a human life, you can absolutely rely on, you are going to get the best outcome possible. If you lose your human life, if you give up the active presence of love, and this word rachma that was the first law was the condition that allowed you to keep a human life, if you gave it up, then you were reduced to a physiological system filled with generations of whatever was there. Good stuff, crazy stuff, hostility, rage, fear, grief, pain, whatever. And a circumstance would happen, and when that circumstance happened, it would resonate in your physiology, whatever was there. If great-great-granddad faced that circumstance and he went into an absolute fit of rage, when you face that circumstance, called up out of your genetic will be that absolute fit of rage, and you may scratch your head. If you've ever done that, you scratch your head and you say, my goodness, what was that about? Why did I go into that rage? That's not like me. Well, the reason was, if you were cut off from the active presence of love, your human life, then you were left with whatever was stored in your physiology, whatever was stored in your genetics. And the whole idea was to recognize that if you maintained a human life, you had a level of power that made no sense in the non-human world. That is, that made no sense in the world of hostility or fear. And so when you look at the whole teaching of the man named Yeshua, it is a brilliant compendium of material, a brilliant gathering of tools and how to remove from your physiology those things that are inhuman and incarnate fully as love in your own physiology. There's an innate drive in everyone to do that because we all start out as the same thing, as the active presence of love. And the world quickly structures us to give that away. And Yeshua said, you've got to reclaim that. And if you're living out of the world's structuring in hostility or fear, then you were living a life that was non-human. And that's the life that he said, in order for you to live, you've got to die. And which, of course, doesn't make sense in any way, shape, or form until you understand this principle. So if we're living a non-human life, if we're living out of whatever stored in our physiology and we think we're that, then we're not truly alive yet. And Yeshua is saying that self has to die in order for the real self to live. In order for the real self to be literally incarnated in our form. And so that was the essence of what he was looking to do, was to support the active presence of a human life and show the power of a human life. Now, with this being Good Friday, there's a powerful principle here that is understandable if you understand it from the point of view of a human life. Sadly, most people look at the whole significance of Good Friday through the non-human self, through the hostility and fear-based mind. I remember being in a particular church one Good Friday and watching them take out a cross, take out a replica of a body, and get out hammers and pound nails and wail and cry over this travesty and this tragedy. Which, interestingly enough, you'll notice the man named Yeshua never did. It wasn't his purpose to have people, thousands of years later, sitting around in their fear and their pain and their sadness and their grief, mourning what he went through. He went through an experience that demonstrated to people the power of a human life, the power of the presence of an actual being called love, in a physiological system that was threatened and being destroyed. And he demonstrated high-level wellness. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, you'll notice that he never gave up his human life in that whole experience. If you go back a little earlier in the process of his teaching, you'll remember that this man named Yeshua said to the disciples, my father has told me I can lay my life down and pick it back up again. Like, wow, that's pretty awesome. And then he gets the message. He gets the message, pardon me, I've got a bit of a frog in my throat, that this weekend is his final exam. And he's not sure he's ready to go through it. He's not sure he's processed enough of his non-human self to go through that experience. And so what does he do? He says to the men he's been teaching how to live a human life. Basically, he's been converting these disciples from non-humanness, from hostility and fear, into humanness, into living by a mind, in a mind fueled with love. So the disciples live in a mind fueled by the world as the world takes it, its hostility and fear. And so 3 years full-time, and this kind of indicates just the work that he calls upon us to do, because he says that, you know, if you're going to actually follow him, you've got to take up your cross. Now, you notice he didn't say take up my cross. You have to face whatever's in your physiology that is based in hostility or fear and work through it if you're going to achieve what he said was possible, and that was the same things he did and greater. So instead of sitting around looking at that whole event from the point of view of pain and fear and sacrifice, which he absolutely said on two occasions his father did not want, there was no desire for sacrifice, and of course we have theologies totally based in sacrifice, in what world does that make sense to say, I believe in the man named Yeshua, but I don't believe what he said, because he said no sacrifice, and my theology says sacrifice is the key. No thinking allowed. We need to start to reason through this and tap into the intelligence that we were given. What was he really doing? Well, he takes the disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane, where he's going to do a final piece of work. He asks the disciples, he asks them to hold the space. He's looking for support for the process work that he needs to do. And this is what we're here to support you in, is to process anything in you that is like hostility or fear. Now, on the way to the garden, you know, the disciples, they're still playing the non-human mind game. They're still playing out of hostility and fear. And in their hostility and fear, Peter says, well, how many swords should we bring in? Yeshua says, just bring one. And you know, when you think about the mind of hostility and fear, who's still believing in a physical battle, and here's the hero who's going to be the king and is going to wipe out the Roman army, can you imagine the fantasy that went through Peter's mind when he was told, you're just going to need one sword? Can you imagine how excited he was that he's going to watch this master of his wipe out the whole Roman army with one sword? Peter has no clue why he was allowed to bring a sword. But Yeshua goes into the garden, and he says, Father, can this cup pass from me? In other words, I'm not sure I'm ready for this. Yes, you told me I could lay my life down and pick it back up again, but I'm not sure it's time yet. Obviously, he's told, yes, you can do this. And so he goes ahead. Now, he taps into the people he brought for support, those who are supposed to be holding a space of love. And he gets a void. So he goes out of the garden and says, and what does he find? He finds the disciples totally asleep, totally unconscious, and unable to hold the space of love. And so when he's approaches them, he's like, can't you guys stay awake for an hour? Can't you hold this space of love that I've been teaching you full-time for 3 years? Can't you do that? And obviously they could not. Why? They had not handled the issue of death. And so he goes back into the garden. Now, we're told he sweat blood in the garden. I would offer the reason he sweat blood is because he had a piece of work to do. That's why he called these men for support. And as a naturopath, we know that the body, the so-called body, is an energy system, and whatever has gone into it has to come out of it. And I would suspect that if you were going to clean up whatever was in you and experience being murdered and then come back to life, you'd have to clean everything out of your field that was like death. And as a naturopath, I would offer that would probably look like sweating blood. And we're told that's what he did. He comes out of the garden, and now we've got, you know, the classic world myth. You know, and the world myth is there's a good guy and a bad guy, and the good guy kills the bad guy and is the hero. And rarely have you ever seen a book or a play or a movie that isn't based upon that. Rarely do you see a dynamic between humans that isn't based upon that bottom line myth. And it is a myth. So he comes out of the garden, and here's the archenemy, the bad guy, the high priest servant. There's Peter, the man with the sword. He's set to be the hero. And there's Yeshua, the innocent victim. Now, I can only imagine that Yeshua would have given Peter the look at the point where he swings the sword at the high priest servant in order to take off his head. Fortunately, he just got an ear. And I can imagine that Yeshua would have kind of dressed Peter down with Peter. That's not what we're here to do. We are here to demonstrate the power of a human life. You're doing non-human stuff. You're in attack. You're living the world myth. And then he informs Peter, and this is a message that has not yet been heard by the world. He informs Peter, Peter, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. He allowed him to bring a sword, not because it was going to be a war, but because he was going to teach him a lesson. And the world hasn't heard this lesson yet. If you live by a piece of violence, if you live by some form of attack, you will die by that same form of attack. That's the creative process. That's what you're setting up. And instead of giving up his human life to the rage and fear that the average person would, he actually followed the first law. He kept the condition of Rachma in his mind. He kept the active presence of a human life. And he goes to the high priest servant who's now injured, the man who he knows is going to shred his body to pieces. And what does he do? Does he dress him down? Does he say, now get out of here or we're going to take you out? No. Out of his beingness, out of his human life and compassion for the man who's controlled by his own past through what's stored in his genetic and his structural system, he reaches forward and he heals the man. Now, the non-human mind would say, Michael, that's crazy. I mean, look at doing that got him dead. Did you notice that? And my feedback is, yes, I did notice that. Did you notice they couldn't keep him that way? And I'd offer that what he came to teach through that whole process, as opposed to the suffering and the sacrifice that most of humanity is still living in because they won't face their own cross, they won't face their own fear, they won't face their own rages, they won't face their own griefs and their own pains, they won't remove them from their form, so they can't incarnate as love, as human beings. And they function out of their hostility and fear. So he demonstrated the power of a human life. And you'll notice right through to the point, on Sunday afternoon, he holds everybody in a blessing of a human life, including the people who are brutally torturing him, including the people who condemned him. And you say, Michael, that got him dead. They couldn't keep him dead. And they couldn't keep him dead because that's the power of a human life. I'd offer that's what he came to teach us. He did not come to teach us the power of suffering and sacrifice and death. He came to teach us the power of the active presence of love, the active presence of a human life in our minds. And what we're here to do, you know, quite likely you're not going to be facing crucifixion anytime soon, but what we're here to do is to support you in being willing, out of this body of work that this genius Yeshua created, we're here to support you being willing to face everything in you that's based in hostility and fear and remove it from your physiology. Literally healing the genetics, healing the generations, and removing the control that the generational behaviors have over you. And as you forgive, and the tool there is forgiveness, and forgiveness isn't about letting other people off the hook. Forgiveness is about going inside yourself and removing the very capacity for hostility and fear so that you get to incarnate a human life. And as an actual presence of love, you have 1,000 times more power, 1,000 times more capability to produce in your world what it is that you really want to produce. Whether it's in your relationships or in your finances, you remember the man said, I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly. Not, I come to bring you suffering and pain and sacrifice and stay focused on that and everything in your life will be okay. He taught that sin was simply engaging in an energy that was off the mark. He didn't adore the word sin and sinner and ask you to take up an identity of sinner. He said it's an energy that's off the mark. Stop doing it. Take it out of your field, not identify with it and solidify yourself in that insanity. And as we remove the very capacity for hostility or fear through forgiveness. And forgiveness has nothing to do with letting other people off the hook for what's happening inside of you. Forgiveness is the tool with which you remove what never belonged inside of you. And as you do, you get to incarnate a human life. And that becomes an absolutely awesome experience. And so with this Good Friday being today, I would invite everyone to tap into literally the devotional energy that is available on the planet and being conscious to be able to, as you tap into that devotional energy, to utilize that energy to cleanse, to remove from yourself any hostilities and fears. Especially hostilities and fears that have come from errant religious instruction. Many people are trapped in the pain and the trauma of the way the teachings of the man named Yeshua have been turned into a non-human experience, have been turned into reason for hostility and fear and terrorizing people. And when you terrorize people in the name of love, you're making a big mistake. And so if you've had any of that terrorizing done to you, we invite you to breathe as you listen to these ideas. We invite you to forgive. If you have not yet tapped into the forgiveness process, I invite you to go to www.whyagain.com, whyagain.com. On the right-hand side, you'll see a link that says Download Worksheets. If you click on the first two links under that link, you'll find a set of instructions for the Aramaic forgiveness process. And the Aramaic forgiveness process is how you go inside yourself and remove what never belonged. Remove every hostility and fear, you step into eternal life. The second link is the actual reality management worksheet, the how-to of forgiveness. And so we invite you to download both of those things. And Jeannie, any comments or questions? Anyone on the phone or comments in the chat room?
No, there's nothing out there. They're just sitting and listening.
Ah, awesome. Well, what we're here to support you in is not a belief in what somebody did 2,000 years ago, but to believe what was offered in the way of tools and do the work. And that means that when you face somebody at the office that's snarly and cranky and you go into frustration, you don't forgive the person who's snarly and cranky. Forgiveness has nothing to do with that. You might choose to pardon them for being snarly and cranky. You go inside yourself and you remove the frustration. You forgive the frustration you experience when someone else is snarly and cranky. You know, yesterday we had Christine who wrote in how she had gone to a restaurant and there was a waitress that was kind of nasty. And because she'd been doing her work, she'd taken on the commitment. She was, if I remember correctly, on her seventh day of 5 worksheets a day. That was what we just suggested you download, was the reality management worksheet. She was on her seventh day of that. And I really appreciate how you shared that yesterday, Christine. And what she shared was, you know, normally I'd have just gotten angry with her and fought fire with fire, in essence. And instead, what was Christine able to do? She was able to maintain Rachma. She was able to maintain her human life. This is just a simple example, but an awesomely powerful example when you start to apply it in each area of your life. And, of course, that's the challenge, being able to apply it in each area in your life. And the closer and closer things get to us, the more intense it becomes to actually apply that. So what Christine shared yesterday was, if you weren't on the show, was that as she watched this woman through the eyes of love instead of her own hostility, resonance, you know, this woman's hostile, and naturally it would resonate hostility in any customer that she would have. But Christine, having risen above that, and standing in a condition of love, looks at this woman and is able to see the pain that she's in. And instead of fire with fire, instead of responding in kind, she brings a new energy into the space of that relationship. A momentary relationship, but a powerful, powerful example. And she brings love into it and is able to soften this woman's pain and create a different result. Now, of course, she could have gone on and gone into her rage and gone off and gone home and kicked her cat while the waitress, being enraged, went off and kicked her cat or kids or whoever or whatever. But instead, both walked away in a more connected space of a human life. That's what happens when you live in and you work in forgiveness. You remove the very capacity for any form of hostility or fear. And as you remove that hostility or fear, you get to experience the delight of what you were designed for, an actual human life, the actual presence of love in your physiology. And you are designed, I would offer, to experience every cell in your structure reflecting back to you that love, that it is designed to be a literal physiological cellular experience, and it's an awesome lesson to learn. Now, it's interesting when you look at the Greek scholarship around this whole topic we're speaking of, because you'll hear the Greeks saying that, or the Greek scholarship proclaiming that they wrote it all down. Well, if you know anybody of a Semitic heritage, I bet you could not fathom that person saying, you know, we've developed this awesome flower of teaching, and we're not going to write it down. We want the Greeks to do it for us. It's like, hey, how ridiculous is that? But don't expect Western scholarship to jump in anytime soon and become overly interested in the Aramaic and the truth, because they're going to have to give up their thrones. The truth is, he didn't speak Greek, he didn't think Greek, he didn't live in a Greek confined mindset. He lived in an Aramaic mindset where he told us that we had a parent who was love, who delighted in bringing us what we wanted, and that he came to bring us life more abundantly. The person who's sitting around looking at that teaching, talking about suffering and sacrifice and pain, is living in an incorrect world, is living in an insane world, and perpetuating needless suffering. The awesomeness of that lesson occurred to Yeshua as he was on the cross. And interestingly enough, if you listen to the Greek translation of the last words, you hear the ultimate of hopelessness. I mean, if you want to keep people in hopelessness, tell them this. Here's God's Son, the offspring of love, who now is abandoned by God. Forsaken was the word the Greeks used. So the last words uttered on the cross were told by the Greeks, were said with dejection and pain. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Now, interestingly enough, even Greek scholarship will say, well, those words were left in the original Aramaic. Well, obviously, if they were left in the original Aramaic, the original was Aramaic. You know, let's get real here. And, of course, the Greek translation always leans toward inspiring some form of hostility, fear, and hopelessness. How much hope does anybody have if God's hanging on a cross, abandoned or forsaken by God? I mean, what a great translation to keep people in suffering and pain and fear and out of what the man came to give us, and that was human life and abundance of human life. So let's look at what the words Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani really mean. First of all, they were not said with dejection and pain. They were said with excitement and enthusiasm. It was not a greeting to some distant God, my God, as the Greeks translated. The greeting was much more intimate. The greeting, the first two expressions there, were more like, ah, Papa, Papa. And then what it says is, instead of, why have you forsaken me? What it says in Aramaic is, ah, for this you set me aside. The word forsaken in Aramaic is similar to the word set aside for a special purpose. Idiomatic. the level of translation that says that he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, is at the same level as you got a low body temperature. It's lost. The meaning is just, I mean, the words are translated perfectly, but there's no meaning there, no transmission of the actual meaning of the words. So here we hear Yeshua, you know, he said to his disciples earlier, I can lay my life down and pick it back up again. And here's where he gets it. Ah, Papa, I got it. If I don't have suffering and death in me, they can destroy my physiology, but they can't kill me. If I maintain my connection to a human life, love, they can't destroy me. Excitement at his insight. I got it. Nothing to do with being forsaken. That is such a terrible translation. But if you look at the Greek mindset is about the gods have to control people. The gods are willing to slaughter their own children. They rape their own mothers. All kinds of crazy things happen. So when you put that slant on it, you've got something that was never said. So here we have the man named Yeshua going, ah, Papa, I got it. I am
Michael.
Safe and secure in love, and I will carry on life for eternity, and I'll rebuild this temple. Jeannie.
I think it's Terry, and he has his hand up. So, Terry, you're on the air.
Hey, come on in, Terry. How are you today, sir?
Excellent.
Oh, good.
I was enjoying the show and tapping into a little bit of the energy around that. And what I wanted to share was some of the benefits. I really wanted to touch on to the benefits that have come to me in taking on this work at a new level and having the support from Heartland to be able to do that. You know, I've experienced improved relationships, and a lot of you have heard stories about my connections with my children and how that's expanded with my mom, and all the relationships have improved, and some of them tremendously, you know, just tremendously. I've experienced a lot of what would come up as fearful realities once I step into them and do some work on them, they just seem to dissolve. You know, they become as nothing. And what started me on this whole thought process was the expanded creativity that I've been experiencing, and particularly in last night and doing a design on one of the potential buildings that we'll do here. I opened up into a space of creativity that I've never experienced before. I was able to see things in different multiple layers as I was working through the process on creating an image of a structure. And that was exciting and fun, you know. I have a love of self. I noticed yesterday I looked in the mirror and I looked at myself and it's like, wow, there's this guy. I really like this guy. I love this guy, you know. That's a real expanded sense of love of self. And one of my favorites is the experience in the actual tasting of the cellular presence of love in my body. You know, those are some pretty powerful, very powerful and beautiful benefits. I wanted to put that out today on this Good Friday. I'm feeling good about all that and want to share it out with the group.
Thank you for sharing that, Terry. That's awesome.
And as we wake up to a human life, suffering, you know, stuff happens, pain happens in everybody's life, but suffering is optional. Actually, I love what Mel Gibson captured in the film The Passion of Christ. And, you know, it's interesting, again, how the world plays the game. And changes the meaning of words. So we have a word that, when it's used in normal context, what are you passionate about? That is, what are you excited about? What delights you? What makes your life tick? When we turn it around to talk about Yeshua, we get into Greek thought, and now It's the suffering and the pain. Let's keep people focused in suffering and pain, because people focused in suffering and pain are pretty low intelligence and they're pretty controllable. Yeshua came to reverse that, to key people back into their intelligence and what they were really capable of. And Terry, that's a great example, as you see that creativity opening. That's what the man named Yeshua came to give us, was the full measure of a human life, not to lock us into suffering and pain. And so as you realize this whole thing that's been turned around into something that's pretty bizarre, that it's about suffering in the name of a creator called love. And so when you go to if you haven't seen the movie The Passion yet, and many people that I've spoken to, well, no, I heard that was just too brutal and too terrible, I wouldn't go to it. Well, excuse me. I promise you, if you go into the theater and watch that film, you will not experience anything you didn't take into the theater with you. Many people have been pounded on by the culture about how you were the sinner that drove in the nails, and so there's a lot of pain and trauma. But I promise you that a few bits of light dancing on a screen and a plastic cone in a speaker cannot produce pain in you, unless there's pain in you. And if you go to that film ready to do your work, if there's any pain and suffering around that whole experience, you will have the opportunity to forgive it. And if you do, you will come out of that theater a better person for having done the work of removing suffering from planet Earth. And you watch that film, and there's actually a pretty awesome scene about process work in that film. And you might remember, if you have seen the film, and if you haven't, I'll describe it for you. Yeshua, of course, he's been brutally beaten. And I don't know whether Mel Gibson would agree with me or not, but I think he captured very well that Yeshua went through pain, but he did not suffer. Suffering is optional. He went through horrific abuse and horrific pain, but there was no suffering. And there's a particular scene where his mother is trying to get to him, and, you know, he's hauling the cross down the road, and he falls. And his mother just can't look, can't watch. And it's a really pretty awesome scene, because what happens is she turns around and she replays in her mind. It shows her doing a forgiveness process. May not be Mel Gibson's take on it, but it was my take on it. So it shows her turning around, and she remembers him as a little boy. This is process work. She turns around, remembers him falling and hurting himself, and she processes through that. And then she's able, once she deals with that past trauma, she's able to go right up to him. And what are his words? As opposed to, oh, look at what they're doing to me, how terrible this is. What does he do? He says, behold, mother, I make all things new. In other words, I am the space of a human life. I am the space of love. Mother, I'm not suffering here. Yeah, they've been doing it to me, but you know what? I'm staying connected to the active presence of love. And therefore, this has no impact upon me. Mother, don't be concerned about it. I'll come out the other side just fine. And that's the power of a human life, to go through the travesties and the tragedies of what happens in our world. And when we bring the power of the active presence of love to bear on those travesties and those tragedies, we transform them. The energy of those experiences is changed. It is transmuted. And we become the space that begins the dissolution of hostility and fear from planet Earth. We become, when we walk through an experience where the average person will go into rage or fear or what have you, terror, trauma, grief, and pain, when we walk through that experience with a human life presence, with the active presence of love, we literally begin the transformation of that energetic presence on the planet. And when enough people will do that, guess what's going to happen? we are individually and collectively going to evaporate all suffering, all insane behavior, all pain, all trauma from planet Earth. We're going to bring a transformation. And the point where that transformation will come, they spoke of in the ancient teachings, and they said the world would be transformed in the twinkling of an eye. Excuse me, the world is not going to be transformed by the presence of your pain or your suffering or your belief in sacrifice. The world will never be transformed by that. The world will be transformed by the active presence of your love. Now, that means that if there's something in me that I cannot stay connected to love in the presence of, I have work to do. Now, what the non-being, what we call the non-being mind does is it turns it all around. It's like, no, no, it's you that's the problem. You're the one who made me angry. You're the one who made me sad. You're the one who made me afraid. Excuse me. If you've been through your anger or sadness or fear 87 different times with 42 different people, I invite you to know this, you're the only one that was there every time. It's about you. It's not about them. And once you recognize that, then when you bring the active presence of love to bear on your suffering, on your pain, by the simple exposure to love, that begins to dissolve. And that's what Yeshua was saying to his mother at that point. Behold, mother, I make all things new. I transform, I transmute the energy of suffering and pain by the presence of my human life. And the things I do, you can do in greater. I'm here to call you out of Egypt. I'm here to call you out of your hostility and fear. And I'm here to support you in learning how to transform all of that and create a new way of living on planet Earth, one that hasn't been around for a long, long, long time. And that new way of living is brought forward by us, willing to face every hostility and fear in us. Forgive, that is, remove it, and be the active presence of love. That's the power of a human life. And that's the power that transformed a beaten, broken, abused body. Because he kept love present, that active presence of love is what transformed his form. And 3 days later, he walked out of the tomb.
Michael?
Yes, speak.
Okay. First, for call-in number, we are 646-200-4169. And Christine, first of all, she said it wasn't her cat that she would kick, it's her dog. But anyway, she goes on to say that she's grateful for you talking about this today. She's going to an Easter service on Sunday for the first time in 25 years, and she's pretty excited about it. What's interesting is that What is interesting about that is that I have spent a long time with anger about my early church experiences. When a lady told me that I would die in a car crash if I didn't accept Jesus as my Savior because my mother was going to be taken away at the sound of the trumpet. Even at 6 years old, I can remember real clearly thinking that these people were crazy, saying that God loves unconditionally, but he was going to punish me by taking away my mother.
Well, you know, where you find threat, where you find hostility, where you find fear, you find a belief system. You don't find God. And, you know, the reason why people come together in community to do the real work of healing is to not learn about love, God. The real reason is to find relationship with God, to cultivate relationship. Why go to church once a week? Because we live in an insanely busy, crazy, complicated world that just it's pretty bizarre. And to take an hour or two a day with the true faith community that's about finding a direct experience of love and cultivating your relationship with that presence of love is an awesome way to support yourself. You know, there's that wonderful African proverb that I've spoken of many times that says, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. when you get a whole community creating a field. You know, if I'm, you know, let's say that the ability to live is the active presence of love we measure on a scale of 1 to 10. If I have an ability to go to a 4 and you have an ability to go to a 7 and he has an ability to go to a 2 and they have an ability to go to a 9, the person who was called the minister theoretically had done their work and was able to hold a space of 10. When you get that community coming together and you just look at it as the energy field that fires from brain cells, if I'm living at a 4 and I can spend a couple of hours in a devotional space with people who live at a 9 or a 10, I get lifted up. I get moved into a new level of experience. And that's the whole idea of community. That's why community has developed around those teachings. Sadly, oftentimes the hierarchy or the leadership in that community, not having done their work, turn it into a fear-based teaching for survival's sake. It's like, I need a paycheck. If nobody comes, where I'm in trouble. And so they turn to using their own fear, projecting their own fear on the people they're supposedly supporting living as love. And in using the fear, they pull the kind of things that you're talking about. And, of course, when you find yourself in a circumstance like that, if you're actually doing your work and taking responsibility, you go, wow, why have I attracted myself into a space where there's such intimidation and fear in the name of God? And here I am in rage. Maybe I have some rage and fear and intimidation issues to heal. Thank you for showing it to me, instead of standing around blaming. And then, you know, some of those same people might be there playing that fear game, but you stand as a space of love, and you bring transformation. So I look forward to hearing next week, Christine, if you have the space, to how it goes as you bring the active presence of love to that experience on Sunday. And I bet you're going to hear some things that in that church you've never heard before. I've had people after doing this work who go back to church, as you say, after many years, and after a sermon they'll go up to the preacher and say, wow, what you said when you said this and when you said that, that was so awesome. And of course, that person had the brain cells to hear what was really being said. And I've had people report back to me that the minister said, I never said such a thing. What are you talking about? I didn't say that. Because the minister didn't have the brain cells for a higher meaning. You know, when you go back to the teachings of Yeshua where he says, you've got to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, I think we can relatively safely assume that pretty much everybody in the audience had what we call physical eyes and ears. So he wasn't talking about that. He was saying you've got to have the brain cells. Someone who has the brain cells for fear around any kind of principle will experience fear there. Someone who has the brain cells for love and that about that same thing will experience love there. We're all continuously experiencing the output of our own minds. And when we clean up the output of our own minds, we get more and more to experience the active presence of a human life and to support human life. It's awesome. And I'm delighted you're on the team to do it. It's fabulous. Any other comments there, sweetie, or questions? Anybody phoning in to 646-200-4169? That's our call-in number. If you have a comment or a question or a thought, all you have to do is click a 1, and we're here to hear you, to support you, and move forward in the actual work of healing. The actual ancient Aramaic tool of forgiveness is the main tool we teach, and of course, we have a whole raft of correlating tools that support people through the healing of all hostility and fear. Let's get planet Earth back to human life, the active presence of love. So, comments or questions?
No, Jeannie? No. Christina just said thank you, and everybody else is just listening. So.
Well, delighted. Delightful.
We're down to about 6 minutes.
6 minutes. So what are we going to talk about in the last 6 minutes? Well, you know, we have a commitment that we teach. And the commitment is something that is designed to give us a word pattern to train our minds to live differently than what our culture's done. You know, our culture says you face somebody who's nasty, you get nasty in return. You know, you got to live in the real world. You got to be tough. You got to be strong. And blah, 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 blah. We're suggesting that. And you can go to the website and download the commitment. Actually, it's in about a dozen or so languages. And we would love help in getting it into some different languages. If anyone looks on our website and looks at the commitment and the language you speak isn't there or somebody you know speaks, we would appreciate having it translated, because what we're looking to do is to take this to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. But the commitment basically gives a word pattern and a set of thoughts for living differently than the world teaches. And so the commitment, and this being this Easter season, in order to resonate and bring forward that active presence of love, I would like to share with you the commitment that opens the space for that which we're talking about, which is the active presence of love, and basically to take it into behavior. In the situations where yesterday there might have been hostility or fear, that we actually behave in a way that is different from the old hostility and fear-based mind. And choosing to live differently, we get to create a whole different world around us and transform the dynamics of relationships in everyone we touch. You know, Christine shared how she transformed the dynamics of the relationship with a waitress the other day out of her willingness to consider living differently. And so the commitment goes like this: I promise to trust you enough to tell you the truth and be true to you, to treat you lovingly, gently, and with respect. In my thoughts, my words, my actions, whether I'm in your presence or not. In every interaction, I will surrender to love our true nature. Recognize that our serenity, my connection to you and our relationship, is more important than any issue. I commit to looking for the highest and best in you as I surrender to love our true nature. I open my heart to embrace you in my love. I open my heart to be embraced by your love. If anything less than love comes up, I will hold this in my heart and listen as we each learn to speak, experience, and be responsible for our own realities. I am here for and with you, keeping communication open and keeping love conscious, active, and present as we heal, celebrate life, and grow together. That's my commitment to you. If in a particular interaction I can't live up to that commitment, then I ask you to be the support space for my healing. And if you can't live up to that commitment, then I will commit to being the support space. Of course, to the best of my ability. We haven't found anybody perfect yet. We're all on the path. We're all learning to move out of the old carbon-based memory dynamics, the old hostility and fear-based mind. And as we do that, we bring transformation not only to our own physiology, but to the lives around us. And we become the blessing that we humans were designed to be. We bring the active presence of love to even the vilest of enemies, as the man named Yeshua demonstrated. He gave us a template and a model of how to actually live a human life, how to be the presence of love, whatever happens, in the presence of the most horrific behaviors, and the transforming power of that love on his own physiology, and for thousands of people, millions of people, through the last 2,000 years. You are the active presence of love. I join you in being the active presence of love and be willing to face everything unlike that love. Transform it. Change your family dynamics, your bloodline, for all of eternity. You have the power to do that. And I join you in having the absolute best year yet of your eternal life. Holy and happy Resurrection Day.